This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report, especially for our patrons.
Our lovely patrons on Patreon. It's people like you that make our show great, again, because we've always been great. But we appreciate your support, so we thought we would release a podcast specifically for you that dovetails around the questions you wanted to ask Ernst.
Yeah, we might let this out in a while, but you'll have access to this exclusively for at least a couple of weeks. So we did ask Ernst, if you don't mind, we did ask our patrons to shoot some questions off at you. I think some of them have been answered. I'll refer to some of them just so people know we're not ignoring them. But so Ryan said, well, he asked if you ever engage with the people who sort of interview you on air and, you know, fight with you, etc., on television or radio, whatever it is, and then sort of go off into a green room or go off air and then have a more sort of relaxed conversation with them. And if they're more sort of open when they're not being filmed or recorded.
Yes, usually I can tell you there was one interview I did, and afterwards I felt that I might have, if I had to do it over, I wouldn't have changed my approach in the interview, but I would have changed what I did afterwards. So some of the viewers might have seen on, when was it? 30 October last year, the Black Monday protests. That evening I was on ENCA and I was just attacked by the host, by Vuyo Mvuku, by I'm trying to remember his name, a commissioner from the Human Rights Commission who used to be an MP for the ANC, and the editor of The Star. And all three of them were just saying, well, this is racist and farm murders shouldn't be a priority. And I, you could see in the interview, I was furious. And I wouldn't say I lost my temper, but people tend to say, well, how do you stay calm during interviews? I wasn't calm in that. So, and then afterwards, what happened afterwards, because I was angry about the fact that just a few hours before that, one of our members was murdered. He was hacked to death, Boki Potgieter. He was hacked to death with a panga. And the only thing they wanted to discuss with was a story that allegedly someone displayed the old South African flag. And the more I tried to say, do you want to discuss the fact that someone was hacked to death with a panga, or do you want to discuss the old South African flag based on dodgy evidence? They interrupted me when I started talking about this member of ours who was murdered. And after the interview, I literally took off my microphone and I said to them, I have better things to do. I took off my microphone, I put it on the table and I walked out. I didn't say goodbye to anyone, but that's the only time I've ever done that. Usually there's not a lot of discussion with hosts or anchors afterwards, because they usually carry on with the program. So you just say hi and goodbye and you walk out. I've had quite a few collegial discussions with Nicholas Bauer. He came to our office to do interviews and we would chat afterwards. So usually it's fine. They wouldn't be as aggressive as they are in the interviews afterwards. But what I can say, I think more interesting than that is the same question with regard to politicians. So I would find that that's, in my view, a major difference between the ANC and the EFF, at least in my experience. That ANC members would have this debate with you, and afterwards they would make jokes. You know, you would one of the jokes I like to tell them is I ask them, what's the difference between a capitalist and a communist? And then they would have this explanation. And then I would say to them, no, the difference is a communist reads Karl Marx, but a capitalist understands Karl Marx. And then they would laugh, and they would, some of them wouldn't get the joke, but with the EFF, it's different. So you can feel that they are racist towards you, that they don't like you, they dislike you just based on the color of your skin, and of course BLF even more so. But with Julius, I've met Julius a few times, and I've spoken with him a few times. It depends on his mood. Sometimes he's in media interviews. Sometimes he's in a happy mood and he makes jokes, and sometimes he's really aggressive. So in the mediations we've had with him after the Shoot the Boer case, so we won the case, then they appealed to the Supreme Court of Appeals. The judge said to them, well, he basically ordered AfriForum and Julius Malema and the ANC to sit around a table, Tau SA as well, the agricultural union, and see if we can reach some form of a mediation. And towards the end, when they agreed they're going to stop singing Shoot the Boer, just as we were walking out, I went to the bathroom and Malema came in. And we were at the sinks, you know, what do you call it, basins, washing our hands. And Malema's, he was at the point of being expelled from the ANC. And he said to me, he made a joke and he said, I'm going to be out of a job soon. Maybe I should come and work for AfriForum. And I said to him, Julius, you don't realize it, but you've been working for AfriForum since you became president of the Youth League. Of course, meaning that he's been encouraging people to sign up to AfriForum. And he laughed and we walked out. So, but another time when I saw him, he threatened to shoot me. So it depends on his mood.
Just one extra sort of add-on to that. Is there any time you've sort of sat down with someone, had a conversation with them, you felt, and I'm talking about prominent people, you felt that they were against you to start off with, or you knew they were against you to start off with, and at the end of the conversation, you felt that they were more on your side or you had convinced them?
Yes. I would say that that has happened a few times with people in the media, not with politicians. They walk in and they walk out with the exact same position they've had. And it's incentivized not to change your view. So I can't remember ever having a discussion with someone from the ANC, for example. And sometimes it would be, you know, constructive discussions and sometimes not. But I find with, and maybe it links to the stereotyping and the false accusations, that what I do find regularly is speaking with people who are commentators or journalists, and then sitting down and having a cup of coffee, and then afterwards they would say, well, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the perception I had about you was wrong. You tend to be much more centrist or level-headed or nuanced than I actually thought you were. I get that a lot, almost on a weekly basis. People say that to me, or, you know, either about me personally or about AfriForum.
Cool. Ramon, you want to...
Yes, so James van den Heever said he watched the video of you in Parliament. He said the committee's reactions were predictable and gratuitous. Your points about the historical analysis of South Africa were good. He says, though, for himself, you are far too combative and you're not seeking any sort of reprise or compromise on your views to get to a middle ground of such. Mm. He likes what you do in theory, but in practice he finds you will not win the argument. Mm. We have spoken about this in the previous podcast, but I mean, what do you say to that?
I think that is a valid criticism. I hate it when people describe themselves as strategists, because I tend to find that people who refer to themselves as strategists tend to not understand how strategy works. So I don't want to say that I'm a strategist, but I do like reading about strategy. And Michael Porter, who's a very well-known business strategist who writes for the Harvard Business Review regularly, he's made a point about strategy, and he says that firstly, how you know someone is not really a strategist is if they tell you about all the stuff that you should be doing. The most important and most difficult thing about strategy is determining what you should not be doing, what the trade-offs would be, because sometimes there would be low-hanging fruit in your way. And if you change your focus, you can go for this low-hanging fruit, and it would be beneficial in the short run, but in the long run, it would be detrimental because you wouldn't have a focus. And I think that's what the DA is suffering from at the moment. But there was a particular strategy with which we went in. And the problem with strategy, or the difficult thing about strategy, is trade-offs. There are certain things that you want to achieve, and following a particular strategy, you have to acknowledge that you are not going to achieve this because your strategy is different. So, yes, we could comment on that, and we can discuss that about the fact that I might have... Because actually everything I said in my presentation was very fact-based. The only part that could be interpreted as emotional or as an insult, as it was described, is the very end, the last paragraph, where I said to them that they are drunk on ideology, and they are drunk on hatred and contempt, and that what they are doing is more detrimental to the poor even and to their own constituency than anyone else. So, yeah, I think the approach was to go in hard, to make it clear that we are not intimidated by them, to sort of draw a line in the sand.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunately the negative consequence of that.
I think, as Ramon has pointed out, the people who didn't go in hard and who were very polite and were very, Well, they gave a presentation you'd kind of, the tone of which is what you would expect from non-parliamentarians coming to parliament.
Yeah, well, it was on the terms set by the parliamentary committee.
And those people received a very similar kickback to what you had. So, I take the point that James is making, but I think difficult call. So, Ken wants to know... given how effective something like the EFF has been, they've got a very small voter base. They only really can get about 6 to 8% in any election. I have no real doubt that next year will be not much different to that. They wanted to basically say, why isn't AfriForum just a political party? Mm. Because look at what the EFF has managed to accomplish. 200,000 members and growing, but 200,000 members would give you, I think, about 4 seats in parliament. Mm. Why not go that way?
Yeah, we wouldn't do that. We always say to people who want us to become a political party that, or ask if we plan to become a political party, that they underestimate our aspirations, meaning that we believe we can achieve a lot more being outside parliament. So let's say we enter politics, we become a political party, and we get 10 times as many votes as we have members, we would still be an opposition party. We would be limited to a very large extent. We always have a saying that the best way to neutralize an activist is to put him in a committee. And that's what's happening in parliament. So you spend most of your time reading reports that are oftentimes a bunch of hogwash, bunch of rubbish. You have to read it, big report, hundreds
of
pages. You've
got to follow processes.
Yeah,
sorry to interrupt, but that's why the National Democratic Revolution has taken this long. Is what you took is, you took a whole bunch of freedom fighters, which are basically activists with guns, and you put them into a government, a bureaucracy, and you said to them, look, you can do whatever you want, guys, but there's like steps. You've got to go through 7 committees before you can do anything you want to do. Mm. And so it's taken them this long to get there.
Yeah, so we would be constrained by parliamentary processes. We would have to sit in parliament like this last week. We would have to sit there for a whole week and listen to submissions by other movements. I think we achieve a lot more, not only from the fact that we are not constrained, but also I think people trust us more, the fact that we're not a political party. So I think we achieve more. If we went, let's say, to the US, as we did earlier this year, as a political party, it would have been more difficult to achieve what we want to do. I think there's a lot of place for political parties, and I think we need proper political parties in South Africa. But us as an organization, we believe our role is outside of party politics.
So Ronaldo Hose, who is a patron of ours, sent me a WhatsApp rather than on Patreon.
That's the guy who has 4 degrees.
I think so.
Yeah.
Something like that. He lives in some shithole called PE or something. Mm. So he's sorry, Ronaldo. You know I love you. So his question is: did you really expect to change the mind of the people on the panel, or did you know going in that it was futile, and that the aggressive approach would be more reportable by the media?
Yes, I didn't expect them. I didn't expect to change any views. I think if my approach was different, I still wouldn't have convinced them otherwise. I also think that judging from what they've said before AfriForum's presentation, they were clearly waiting for us. So frequently, almost every day, they made some reference to AfriForum, who's still coming to this, not in a way in which they are looking forward to give us hugs and kisses. So they were clearly expecting a fight. And even if we were very, very mild, they would still have done that. I think so. I don't think for us, it was not so much about being reportable. In other words, it wasn't for the presentation to be newsworthy. I think that's a spin-off of the strategy. It was more to point out to them that we know what they are doing, and to point out to them that we are not intimidated by them, and let's not compare to other organizations in South Africa. Again, I'm not saying they're Nazis, but let's use the Nazi example. We're not like Neville Chamberlain. We would rather take the Winston Churchill approach. And I think it was important to point that out. That was the most important reason or motive for the approach.
Cool. Then from Bradley, Ramon's giving everyone surnames. I'm keeping the surnames off. I'm not sure if people... I'm not sure where people fall, but Bradley's asked, Well, he's given some suggestions, but I think they might be some good things for discussion. The one is that he feels that you should be denouncing the old SA flag because it was mentioned recently that AfriForum always present the old flag during protests. He says, hopefully not true, but denouncing it will show goodwill and prove that you're not racist. Mm. Okay, I have some thoughts on that as well. I'll just go through all of them and then we go through them one by one. He says we should be using AfriForum's deep pockets to help a cross-section of the population. So he says that, you know, the Dr. Matodi story, for example, convinced him to actually donate to AfriForum. He just suggested that you keep up the international pressure because it seems to be the only stick that works. And I think you've discussed that. So let's leave that aside. Let's talk about the two things, the old flag, the old South African flag, and then how you decide who you help and whether that can be a more diverse grouping, so to speak.
Well, my favorite quote on freedom of speech is a quote by Douglas Murray, who said that the problem with defending freedom of speech is that you never get to do it on the terms that you would have hoped for. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had to defend anything. So our view on the old South African flag has always been that we respect the right of people to display the flag, although we encourage people not to do so. So at our events, we do not display the old South African flag, and there are some angry people who could testify that they tried to show up with the old South African flag at an AfriForum event, and we asked them to put it away. We've done so quite a few times. What I have said in our court documents is, I think the words were, we have no particular love for the flag. I think the flag, and that this is my personal view, I think the flag, it's a political flag. It's not a flag that represents Afrikaners as a community. And I think I, for example, distinguish between the Vierkleur and the old South African flag, which many people think it's the same thing. I attach some value to the Vierkleur, which is the flag under which the Boers fought the Boer War. I regard that as a cultural flag, and the old South African flag, the Oranje Blanje Blou, as it is known, I regard as a political flag.
Just visually, what's the difference?
So the Vierkleur is the one that has a blue bar to the right, and then it's orange, white, and green to the side of the flag, and then it's orange, white, and blue. The old South African flag is It's green to the side, and then it's red, white, and blue. That's the Vierkleur. The old South African flag is orange, white, and blue, and then it has the three little flags in the middle. So I regard the Vierkleur as a cultural flag to which I personally attach value, as someone who's great-grandfather was in that war. But we discourage our members to display either of those flags. And the reason why is we believe that it's not constructive. Unfortunately, the AWB has put a big, as we say in Afrikaans, a brandewijn vlek or a brandy stain on the Vierkleur as well. So the flag is now associated with being right-wing or AWB. And it's unfortunately a stereotype or a battle of ideas that we have to engage with. And we don't want to give unnecessary ammunition to our opponents to try to discredit us. So then the issue with the old South African flag is the Nelson Mandela Foundation went to court and they applied, and it's a court case that's coming up. They basically approached court for a declaratory order that the old South African flag is hate speech, only to display it, only to show the flag to someone is hate speech, and therefore the flag has to be banned. And despite the fact that we have always said to people, we do not think it's a good idea to display the flag, they then added AfriForum as a respondent. So they want AfriForum to oppose them. And it was a difficult decision for us because, firstly, we don't display the flag. But secondly, we believe that this is an issue of freedom of speech. And displaying a flag couldn't be hate speech. So we decided that we are going to oppose it. And we describe ourselves in the legal documents as a reluctant opponent. We are in this fight in the interest of freedom of speech, but not because we display the flag at all.
With any passion.
Yeah.
I think what's important here is it's not about that flag. It's about freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Today, it's banning that flag because a certain grouping of people, or maybe even a large grouping of people, find that flag to be hurtful, distasteful, whatever it happens to be. In 10, 20, 30 years' time, 50 years' time, maybe it's a different flag. Maybe it's not a flag, it's your T-shirt. Maybe it's not your T-shirt, it's the way you look.
It's the book you read.
Yep.
It's the YouTube video you're watching.
It's the podcast you listen to. And I think
it's a slippery slope.
That's really the point. The point is, once you start banning one form of expression, you have to kind of consider that all of them might get banned.
Right. And this is not a question, but it's exactly the EWC principle. We'll only take unused land for now.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's why I mentioned the Nazi example, is because, so what Hitler did is he invaded the Rhineland, which he, according to the Treaty of Versailles, wasn't allowed to do. And then he started occupying some parts of Czechoslovakia, if I recall. And then the international community became concerned. They thought, well, this guy's going to start a civil war. A world war. Yep. And they went and they had discussions with him. And it was Chamberlain. And who was it from France? It wasn't de Gaulle. It was the guy who was before de Gaulle. And then it was Mussolini and Hitler. And they had these discussions. And they basically said to him, listen, we don't like what you did, but it's fine. You can take the Rhineland. You can take those parts of Czechoslovakia.
But just stop now.
Now you must stop. Yeah. And then, okay, are we fine? And then Hitler said, okay, fine. And after so Neville Chamberlain went back to England with a signed agreement. And there's a video of YouTube with him waving it and people cheering. Yeah. And
a famous photograph as well.
Yes. And basically he said to them that, I think he used the term, peace in our lifetime. And Adolf Hitler went back and he said, well, I've met these people and they are weak, so we can continue. So, that's the major difference, I think, in approach.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think, sorry.
Oh no, that's my turn.
I just wanted to that second point about AfriForum using their deep pockets, inverted commas. I think if you've ever been to AfriForum, you will realize that they actually spend their money, I would say wisely, but they do spend it on serving their community. So there's for example, I've seen some of the projects you do around farms and trying to keep farms safe. Mm. So I don't know how deep your product, I don't think you've got tons of money sitting around doing nothing. Mm. But in terms of, you know, he's saying, look, when he saw you helping this guy in Pretoria, it made him want to give you some cash. And it also sort of doused the flames of, oh no, these are just sort of an Afrikaans whites only organization.
Mm. Yeah. So firstly, well, I know people like to make the calculations to try to work out, well, if you have so many members and they each contribute monthly, how much money do you have? It costs a lot of money to run an organization. So I'm not the financial manager or the CFO. But it's about 40% to 50% of our money we spend on just keeping the administration systems running and the overheads and so forth. And then we are involved with a lot of other stuff, or a lot of stuff as an organization. So we're a non-profit. We don't have shareholders. So we don't use the term profit at all, because we don't make profit. Any surplus, we try to invest as a backup plan. So if everything crashes and burns, if we have the worst case scenario in South Africa, so that AfriForum would still be able to continue. But we are involved with a lot of things, and our main priority, our number one focus, is safety. So we have about roughly 120 branches across South Africa, AfriForum branches in local communities. We have more or less the same amount of community safety networks, which is a voluntary thing where people, we provide them with equipment, radios and so forth. And so there's a lot that we do there. And we have about 7,000 volunteers who are involved with driving patrols and in the whole safety project. That's where most of our resources is spent. But to get to the question about, I had an interview, interesting interview just a few days ago, exactly about that, on 702 with Joanne. And she said to me, I think she said something along the lines of, yes, but why don't you help black people? And I started listing black people who we've gone to court for on behalf of. And there's a long list. The most recent case is this Dr. Motori Maserumule. We assisted Gabriela Engels. We are in the process of assisting the black community of Nkandla, who government promised them a school 20 years ago. It's little primary school children. They have to walk through a river every day to get to school. It's just down the road from Nkandla. So we are going to court on their behalf. We've gone to court on behalf of the community of Valmanstal, north of Pretoria, whose property was invaded. There's a long list. The Dube family, who were the lady who was killed by Dudizane Zuma. So there's a whole long list. And then the question would be, oh, but you're just doing this for PR. So the response is, how many such cases do we need to take on for us to disprove that it's just for positioning?
I'm not racist because I've got a black friend argument. Yeah. They put, but we help black people. Oh, yes, but that's just, you know, not real help.
Not enough.
Yeah. So the accusation is you never help black people. Then we list them and then they say, well, no, that's just PR. So the point is that it's a principled-based organization. And we do have a focus on minority rights, but one of the core things that we stand for is the protection of property rights. So if the land of a black community is being invaded, and especially when government refuses to help them, then we would intervene.
Cool. Roman, right. Now it's your turn.
So Neil, no surname, says hypothetically the land starts being seized, farms start being seized by the government without compensation, province by province. What's your plan then? I mean, assuming, do you go to court, or is there another plan?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer because it would depend on the details. It would depend on how this is happening and what is happening. So, regardless of AfriForum's involvement, people would protect themselves. I know enough farmers protect themselves and their property. I know enough farmers who have said to me that if they try to take his land, he would rather die on his farm than to concede and pack up his stuff and leave. And that's why it doesn't make sense for the ANC or the EFF to say we're going to do the same thing as what happened in Zimbabwe, but this time there's not going to be violence, because the question of whether there would be violence depends on the person whose property is being taken. So that's, I think, a major risk. And if that were to happen, then we would want to be prepared to assist people in a responsible manner. But the most appropriate thing to do in that situation would be to use the courts to try to get an urgent interdict, to try to get some police involvement. And if that fails, I think another appropriate step to take would be to get United Nations involvement. But I know we know the UN doesn't have a very good track record of preventing.
I just want to clarify a point there, because when this does get released to public and not just to patrons, you are not advocating for violence.
No. We're doing the opposite. Yeah.
Yeah. You want to try legal methods and legal means.
Yes.
Yeah, I just hear appeasement.
All right. Gareth, I'm not going to re-ask your question, but Gareth's question was essentially if you can give feedback about your comments and questions during Parliament. And I think we've covered that extensively in the main podcast. And then finally, George says that government sort of loves to say that we have free and fair judiciary. And he basically wants to know, if you can't challenge the core argument for expropriation without compensation, you know, the whole idea that white people stole the land, basically, and it's not more complex than that, if that couldn't be taken to court. And in court, you can't get emotional. You have to present, patent fact. And then it goes up for that to be argued, and if it needs be, all the way to the Constitutional Court.
Yeah.
Which I just want to say does not in recent times have the best track record in terms of property rights.
Yeah.
Ruled against farmers having mineral rights on their own property.
Well, everyone having mineral rights, yeah.
Yeah, so we discussed a bit of this also during the previous podcast. My concerns, or our concerns, about what's happening in the Constitutional Court. And I think to summarize that is the Constitutional Court, the courts in general, but particularly the Constitutional Court, is not as nonpartisan as people tend to think. They still, the majority of people on the Judicial Service Commission are politicians, and there's a big difference between court judgments that are based on administrative or procedural issues, where they quite easily rule against the ANC or the ruling party, such as the Sasa judgment, the Nkandla judgment, and so forth, or when it has to do with faction fighting within the ruling party or the ruling elite, they would sometimes choose a side. But when it has to do with ideological issues, almost every time they've interpreted the constitution in a way that supports the narrative of the ANC. So in the Renata Barnard case, they said that, yes, affirmative action is not discrimination. It's an execution of the constitutional mandate. In the recent judgment about the language policy at the University of the Free State, they said, yes, despite the fact that the constitution says that there are 11 official languages and it must be protected where reasonably practicable, The court said it's not reasonably practicable because some of the people in the Afrikaans classes are racist, therefore they shouldn't be able to study in Afrikaans. Of course, not even considering that other people might also be racist. So they were, and then you mentioned the AgriSA case with mineral rights. So there's a list. There was the FEDSAS case where the court found that the government has a bigger right to intervene in terms of school policies than the governing body of the school, which is voted in by parents. So our concern is we use the courts. It's a very big part of our strategy, but we try to go to court on procedural issues where we believe we can win, as opposed to asking the court to make a judgment on an ideological issue.
Yeah, because there you're more likely to lose because the judges themselves are somewhat ideological. Mm. And at the constitutional court level, let's not forget that we have a constitution that is ideological.
Yeah.
You know, we have a constitution that promises a whole bunch of free things. It's Bernie Sanders's wet dream. And so even if they are completely non-ideological, in interpreting that, they're immediately interpreting, in some respect, a partly socialist document.
Yeah, but I mean, it can be a libertarian document too. You have the right to education. Okay, school vouchers, you know. That is a viable possibility. But the program of the state that's being reviewed by court is always a very statist one.
Yeah.
There's never been an alternative other than the status one being reviewed in court.
So for example, the mineral rights case, it's one thing to rule about the procedural aspects, but what Chief Justice Mogoeng said in that judgment was that the state should own the minerals because it would be good for the economy if the state intervenes. So he's pretending to be an economist, and he makes claims about what would be in the interest of the country's economy, despite the fact that that wasn't even the question that was asked.
The most important part of the AgriSA case. Sorry, Jonathan keeps deplatforming me in my own podcast. The state does not expropriate because they have to pay compensation, so they become custodians.
Yes.
And that is not ownership, because fuck knows why. Mm. That's the same principle that applies, but because they become custodians, they don't have to, give compensation.
Yeah.
The ruling is a devastating ruling for property rights in this country, and vastly underappreciated as an attack on property rights. And if the ANC just comes out and says we'll expropriate and become the custodians of the land, the precedent set by the mineral rights case is not good.
Yes. No, exactly. And the president said they could also be used in many ways on other aspects as well.
Exactly. And besides, I mean, the fact that this gentleman asked this question about the battle ideas being fought in court, I think that's the completely wrong platform to fight the battle of ideas.
Yeah.
Historical accuracy is not meant to be a legal proposition.
So maybe the best example is the one I didn't mention, and that was the street names case, which was also a judgment by the Constitutional Court by the Chief Justice, where AfriForum versus the Tshwane Metro, and our entire case was built around the fact that the legal procedures weren't followed, that the process was illegal, therefore the outcome should be regarded as illegal. And basically what Mogoeng said, he spoke about substance over form, and what he meant by that is, yes, he conceded that the process was illegal, but the outcome was noble.
Yeah, fruit of the poison tree.
Yeah, the outcome was noble, therefore it was legal. He declared it to be illegal while acknowledging that they didn't follow the correct procedures.
And this is a man that's praised, you know, the Chief Justice is praised for slapping Zuma on the wrist when he does something objectionably bad, which any other judge would slap on the wrist too. They're fiercely independent in the same echo chamber.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Right. So, Ramon, is there anything further from you?
No, Ernst. I won't tell you this in person and not in public, but I think I'm not a patriot, but I think you are, to some degree, and I think you are a great South African, and I think AfriForum is doing, if he does exist, God's work.
Thank you very much.
No, really, you got hundreds of thousands of people donating money to you, skin in the game. You get attacked mercilessly for things you don't do and don't say, And you keep doing it. You write books, you write articles, you go to court, you get insulted every day. So I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, but I just want to say well done. And you have the support of myself, maybe not of Jonathan at this moment. I don't speak on his behalf. But you keep going. And thank you for what you do. I think it's more South Africans should appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Well, I echo those sentiments, and you do have my support, as do all organizations who are fighting against EWC specifically. You know, we've had yourself on, we've had France on. We should have someone from the
Free Market Foundation.
Sorry, I remembered FMF and then couldn't remember what it stood for. But yeah, I think these are incredibly important discussions. And I have said it before on the podcast, but I really do believe that the future of this country hinges on this particular matter. NHI is a similar area of concern I have. I'm from that arena. And we have to fight it, and you're doing a sterling job. So thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your support as well.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for listening to the Renegade Report. Most importantly, you guys donate to the show. We truly, truly appreciate it. You enable us to keep going, to come here on a Friday and make it happen on and every other day, and to hopefully grow from strength to strength. So keep listening, keep supporting us, and we'll catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.